Welcome to Transform Now, the podcast brought to you by robotic process automation pioneer SS&C Blue Prism. Digital transformation has the potential to reshape the way companies service their customers, engage their employees, and manage their operations. Whether you're looking to develop strategies, tactics, or best practices to positively impact the future of work, or you're curious to see how other companies have successfully navigated their digital transformation programs, then this podcast is for you. We're here to help you transform now.
Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Marchuk. Welcome to the Transform Now podcast. In this episode, I'll be chatting with Max Sklar. Max is a longtime machine learning engineer and an alum of Foursquare. We'll be chatting with Max on the social implications of generative AI. So stay tuned. This is going to be interesting. Welcome, Max.
Hi, good to be here.
I'm glad you are here. So I'm sure I didn't give the full enough intro. So maybe if you could introduce yourself, let some folks know what you've been doing.
Oh, yeah. Like you said, I'm a longtime machine learning engineer and software engineer. I really loved working on Foursquare's app back in the day, which some of you might remember. People were checking in and competing with their friends for mayorships. But I was really into the recommendation systems, the algorithm for picking venues and picking restaurants. And obviously working on that helped my day-to-day social life as well. Back at the time, I was always like, I went to school and studied vector calculus for all these years just so I could find the perfect burger. So that's probably been one of the highlights of my career, to be honest. But later after that, obviously the priorities changed and Foursquare became an enterprise company. And I worked on some of the data analysis and statistical models that went into measuring ad effectiveness and cleaning up data and that sort of thing. And then I did a few years on Foursquare's innovation lab, where I got to put out a chatbot called Marsbot. And we updated that a few times. That was a lot of fun. And then I started my podcast, The Local Maximum. And so it's a lot of fun. We do something different every week. I'm always surprised when I get into the very abstract mathematical stuff, how many people come out of the woodwork saying, I really like that abstract mathematical stuff, because I'm talking about like ordinal, transfinite ordinal numbers here. But I don't know. I have a very unique audience.
Gotcha. Always trying to stretch the brain there.
Yeah.
You've been working with machine learning for quite a while now, and you've seen the developments with large language models and some of the new generative AI components as they've grown from a ChatGPT last fall through all the sorts of things that have evolved since then, because there's quite a bit of expansion in large language models from both a textual capabilities, but also from a creative capability from music and graphics and whatnot. So with all these changes, what's changed recently that the way that humans are interacting with AI, with all the changes that you've seen?
I think with generative AI, the opportunity that you have today is you could take whatever world that you are imagining in your mind and have a machine conjure it up. So for example, if you're imagining an image, if you're imagining just how the world works a different way, you don't have to go to art school and work. So you don't have to write. You could just conjure these up almost instantaneously with generative AI. What are the implications of that in terms of how we interact with these machines?
So the idea that generative AI has opened these doors to allow folks to consume data or consume information in a different way. Instead of reading a 500-page PDF document that was put out over whatever, it can be summarized into 17 sentences that make a lot of sense. It's basically the Cliff Notes version of all the stuff that has been put out there. Obviously, for marketing departments who produce the 500 pages, they may be disappointed about that. But the reality is, it's helping people consume that information and decide whether or not they want to go into the next step. So as you're looking at business cases, the converse is true also. I can take one sentence and have it produce 500 pages.
Right.
So when you start building out these concepts, we as people are interacting with the AI in ways that engage a different part of our brain. It's more on the creative or the inspirational side, because I'd like to see this. I'm trying to find out. I'm looking for, and we're engaging AI that way. Do you see that changing the way we interact with our, say, business applications? I've got a room full of data somewhere, and as a salesperson, I want to understand, what are my customers looking at right now? What are they looking towards that I'm offering that I can either do better with or I can improve upon to give them a better experience with our organization? So how are we seeing that be affected by generative AI?
Yeah, so one of the great things about generative AI, particularly like these large language models, is the not complete abolition, but the head-on attack of writer's block, trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to write today? Now, that could be a marketing person. That could also be a data person. They want to know, okay, I want to query my database. Here's what I have available to me. Here are my database tables. Here's a description of my company's data. Write me a SQL query. I don't know if how many people out there have been using these things for that, but it's such a great way to maintain flow at work. And I think you've always been a lot of products that let you visualize your data and query your data very easily. That was a big focus on businesses in the last decade and will be in this decade. But I think we've taken a turn in this case where it's, okay, at least what I would like to do is I would like to see applications where instead of asking queries of your data directly, the AI can help you answer, okay, what queries should I be asking? What should I be asking about my data and my company that I'm not asking? You could get ideas for that. I think idea generation is underrated, even if they're not all right, but just the ability to generate 10 ideas, 100 ideas on the fly is just extremely valuable.
So you bring up a good point, which is there are two ways of approaching this. So from a technology or technical standpoint, we've had for ages, we've had people who were immersed in the data, their database engineers and folks who were data scientists, but they were always being guided by someone from the business. Hey, I need this. And then the very smart person and data scientist would go and work out what that means and how to get that data, how to create it, how to produce it, and then how to put it back into the hands of the business user who could then understand it. Are you seeing a short circuit from that now with the capabilities that generative AI has connecting with the data sources that we have in our organizations, allowing the business users now to have more direct access to that?
Yeah, you always want to allow your client to have more and more insight into what their data says. And I think it's just a different approach now than you had before. You still are using the same approach that you have before in some regards. Like, okay, I want more dashboards and more queries I can do. And that gets very confusing at a time. Now, I think on top of that, you have to have kind of a more, maybe people are thinking more about the human dimension of that, where it's, okay, what should I be asking now? I'm in situation X. Here is Y and Z that I should be asking. I think that's one step more abstract, which is pretty interesting.
Gotcha. So do you think we're adapting to the ways that machines interact or the interactions between machines and people becoming more human?
I would say it's always a little bit of both. It's always a job and an adjustment to figure out how to get the most from your tools. And so whether they're data science tools, whether you're just someone on the business side who's trying to query the data, or whether you're using some of these generative tools to speed things up, there's always a lot of discussion about these. I'm sure you've seen the big discussions that are going on nowadays. Oh, here's how to do the best prompts, which I think are interesting to read. Maybe trial and error is probably the best way to do it for most people. But I think that on the flip side is machines adapting to humans. That's what product folks do and designers do, and software engineers as well, when they're working with product and design, which is try to figure out, okay, how can we build something that's the most natural? How can we make the machine disappear? And that's why I think generative AI has taken the imagination by storm, because it's made the code disappear in some cases. It's made the feeling that you're talking to a machine disappear in some cases. And so I think that's the goal, but there's always going to be a mismatch. There's always going to be progress on one side and progress on the other side.
You mentioned something that made me think of the first part, which is having a cheat sheet to tell you how to talk to ChatGPT is really something that's trying to educate us humans on the best way to interface with a machine.
Yeah. I think another thing that a couple months ago, I had a project where I like saw the future, all this stuff, and I realized, okay, a lot of people are talking to these ChatGPT one-on-one or some of these image generation systems, which are pretty neat. And you get, you see these interesting things on Twitter all the time. But I think a lot of it's not going to be a one-on-one. A lot of it is going to be automated tapping into these models where you're going to have machines generate gigabytes, terabytes, I don't know, of text for an organization. And so it's going to be, okay, we have infinite content now. How do we pick which content we're going to use? And I don't know what the future, I think there's going to be a big future in kind of data engineering and try to figure out how to suss that all out. But that's a big problem that I'm thinking about right now. Yeah, I feel like I went down a rabbit hole. There was another question that you had.
No, it's good. Again, the concepts I was, again, related to training us on how we are going to be talking with the machines is probably the biggest key. But you mentioned this about training and data, access to data. We've seen this a bunch of times where, with whether it's with the intellectual property cases that are being brought up now in terms of, hey, you read my book and therefore you're using my intellectual property because that was copyrighted material to train your system on. Or even more blatant was, hey, you used my pre-tagged images in the Getty archives without our permission to do so. And now this is an issue because we explicitly said you can't use that. So this whole training and access to data ends up making things more challenging when we look at these broader large language models. What are the implications we have for organizations who are going to be using these large language models, either the public versions or training up a more private version through an AWS model kind of thing, where they're having their own internal large language model? What are the implications for privacy and the governance that goes along with that?
I think we're going to have a lot of problems to work out. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about this company called Prosecraft. And I say company, but it was really just one guy who was doing a website where he was analyzing the kind of literary statistics of different books, what grade level they were, which words they tended to use. And some of the publishers and writers were furious that he was stealing stuff and he was using that was the language they used. And it feels the current, both the legal framework and the ideas that people have about intellectual property and copyright are preventing innovation that probably should be happening. And it's going to be a very sensitive subject because writers really care about their work. Publishers and the owners of the content are going to defend it. And so it's going to be, I think that these kinds of conflicts and fights will continue. And I think we're going to see a lot of legal action, a lot of governance action around that. Another conversation I had a couple of years ago with Patricia Fain. She's an entrepreneur who founded Private AI, which is a company that redacts secrets basically from training data for machine learning models. And, you know, that stuff is big business. And there are a lot of entrepreneurs trying to figure it out. There are a lot of companies trying to figure out. So it should be, I think for most organizations, it should be baked into what you do.
That whole baking part, though, the building a governance model around it, I think is still evolving. How do you approach technologies like this, an insurance company or a bank, someone who's been around for 100 years, which we don't even have legal precedence against some of the questions that we've been asked right now, like we talked about intellectual property and copyright and training models and whatnot. How do you approach technologies where perhaps you're not sure what kind of legal liability you have?
I would ask a lawyer on that one, but I think from a technical side, in terms of trying to figure out, okay, I'm going to build a model based on some data that might be private. How can someone reverse engineer that model and figure out the private data? And I don't know, maybe just off the top of my head, spitballing here, maybe have a team that actually is trying to do it, trying to take your models and trying to reverse engineer the original data. So that way, if they're getting close or if it could be done, I don't know if they'd be willing to invest in that, but that seems like a good idea, white hat type folks. But when I talk about baking it in, I just mean like in every iteration of the whatever product you're trying to build. You mentioned an insurance company. Let's suppose that, okay, I'm building a model to try to figure out, you know, how much to charge someone for insurance. And there are a lot of legal implications around that too. I don't think that you could just use any model. I think there's also a problem where, you know, if the model gets trained in a certain way, then it's considered illegal discrimination. You might have an issue there. So there might be a specific way that you have to train the model. And then I guess, I don't know, after that, it's just, do I have data practices that are, and data kind of security hygiene practices that can just ensure that this data is going to be secure? who's going to be using the model. If it's just an internal thing, then I don't know, it seems pretty secure so long as the internal servers are secure. So it's just all goes back to like general security then.
Yeah. Sounds like I need to have a lawyer, an intellectual property lawyer on to ask some of these questions, because these are things that I've heard from customers, and it's very interesting to start pondering them. We've heard for a long time that this whole, the AI is marching forward, and at some point AI is going to become self-aware, and then what? But in, from your perspective, what does a sentient AI actually look like?
I'll try to answer that question in a second, but I'm going to dodge a little bit here because or step back a little bit here because I am actually not sure that a sentient AI or a conscious AI is actually even possible or possible to define, really. Actually, I recently read a book on consciousness. It's called The Case Against Reality with Donald Hoffman. And basically, it's amazing how no one can actually tell us what consciousness is. Scientists have been debating this back and forth, and they seem no closer to being able to do it than they were 20 years ago, 100 years ago. We've learned a lot about how the brain works. Yeah, we could like manipulate people's brains and have them experience things, but that still doesn't tell us anything about where that experience comes from. So it feels like these machines are not experiencing anything. They're just maybe extensions of our own brains to help us see the world a little bit better. For example, let's take large language models. Like, language is a human invention. And LLMs is just an innovation that allows us to, in some cases, use language faster, more effectively, or more efficiently, or maybe it's a quantitative improvement, not a qualitative improvement. But still, it feels like this is an extension of our own brains, just like a lot of the things that are happening in our own brains, we don't know what's going on. So in terms of sentient AI, a lot of people have also been talking about how, okay, what happens if someone builds an AI that kind of has its own purposes and gets out of control and starts doing things that it shouldn't be doing. I think that as humans, we have a lot of systems that can go out of control. We have large organizations and governments that get certain orders and they follow them, maybe without thought about what the implications are. You have the economy as a whole, like lots of economic actors doing things. How does that affect the macro picture? We don't control that. That's a super intelligence that we just live with. And sometimes we get pushed this way and that in the economy, and we don't really know why. Some prices are up, some prices are down. We've got to adjust our business thinking. So I don't know what we can do to mitigate any of those risks to AI in terms of AI getting out of control. This may be where my lack of imagination is preventing me from seeing it. But I asked the large language model to give me lots of examples on what could go wrong. And they're all very hand-wavy. Oh, someone could like say something and it could be taken the wrong way. I have yet to see a specific threat in that case. A lot of the people who are worried about this are like, they're so going to be so smart, you can't see the threat. So it's like, all right, but I don't know what to do with that.
I suspect we have it the same from the reverse side in terms of the opportunities that it provides to us as well.
Absolutely.
Because of the vast amount of data and the model training to allow us to see things differently that's within that data, and even bringing up new questions when we find out what we didn't even know before to look into it even further. So there's a lot of opportunities I think we have, as well as the potential threats that go along with it. And as this is all evolving, I'm sure that we're going to have a lot of things to be talking about over the next several years as this does come into more focus.
Yeah. If I give an example, Marsbot, which was the like kind of chat bot we worked on at Foursquare, it wasn't very sophisticated chat bot, but the machine learning on that was baked into what it was recommending in terms of, you'd walk into a cafe and it would tell you exactly what to order, which was pretty cool. But I liked the idea behind it, which was like your personal assistant that was there to look out for your interests during the day. And if someone can build and find a way to make it an economically viable business, because a lot of the problems is a lot of these businesses that provide services to help us are really there to serve us ads, which, hey, this business, you got to do it. But I would like to see more business models where the goal is to build an agent that looks out for your interests. And whether that's just something like we're working on Foursquare to help you have fun and assist your social life, or if it's something that could like recommend to you jobs or career paths or give you help in your personal lives, your relationships, where you should move, all of these things.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it does open up your imagination of what could be that perspective. Mm-hmm. All right. So you've already showed us one book that you read now, and which I think is very interesting. Yeah. I'm always interested to find out, especially in this field, you're a very technical person and you're working with machine learning and AI and these language models and the mechanics behind it. But you're reading a book on consciousness. What other books that would you recommend for folks who are looking at this from a sort of a non-technical or a future state kind of way?
Oh, that's interesting. I feel like I've read so many books on this topic. Recently, David Auerbach wrote a book called MegaNets, which I read and I enjoyed it. It was about these large data systems and large, massively multiplayer games, but then made the analogy to other systems like social networks and large data systems, how the organization that controls these things doesn't really have total control over it. Maybe they can have an off switch to turn it down. They're not going to, Twitter is not going to be like, oh, some people are doing stuff we don't like. We're just going to turn off Twitter right now. So they have some knobs, they have some fiddles, but they're walking around headless trying to figure out what to do most of the time. So I felt like that was a very interesting book. It was non-technical and it gave you an idea of how to think about some of these kind of large scale systems and technology, because it's not just that you have some dictator there who says, make it like this, make it like that. It doesn't quite work like that. So that's an interesting one that I read recently. Oh, really interesting person. I've actually been this person for many years in the New York tech scene. His name is Chris Wiggins. He's a professor at Columbia, and he is also, I think, I don't know, his title is the New York Times, but it might be like chief data scientist or something. But he recently teamed up with a historian at Columbia and wrote a book called How Data Happened, which is a history of data science going all the way back to the 1800s. And so that's really fascinating, because a lot of the problems that we face today are just different iterations of problems that were faced in the past. So I thought that was very interesting, and particularly for someone who's non-technical, who's a curious person, they might enjoy reading something like that.
Very good. Very good. Max, it was a pleasure having you on the show today. I'm really glad that you were able to join us and talk through some of these issues related to machine learning, the data, and the AI. Really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a lot of fun.
Thanks for tuning in to Transform Now. For more insightful discussions on digital transformation and more, check out our podcast channel where you'll find all of our previous episodes. And to make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast player. And if you like what you've heard, please leave us a review. For more information about digital transformation and the future of work, check out blueprism.com to learn how SS&C Blue Prism's digital workforce is enabling enterprise transformation now.